This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. Plastic. We all know it's a problem. It's been estimated that between 500 billion and 1 trillion plastic bags are manufactured across the world each year. In the US alone, 12 million barrels of oil go towards plastic bag production. And with the popularity of bottled water, the number of plastic bottles disposed of every year around the world has soared to 200 billion. This massive use of quote-unquote disposable plastics creates an enormous amount of harmful waste and exacerbates our unhealthy reliance on petroleum. So what is to be done? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with a leader of an organization that's trying to raise awareness of a particular plastic problem, and with a scientist whose team is developing a new process that could actually help solve the plastic problem. First, we talk with Doug Woodring, a Hong Kong-based entrepreneur and environmentalist whose project Kaisei is making strides to highlight the enormous floating plastic mass in the North Pacific known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Then we hear from the head of IBM's Almaden Research Center, Chandrasekhar Spike Narayan, who describes his team's latest breakthrough, an earth-friendly, endlessly recyclable plastic. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Doug Woodring. He's one of the founders of Project Kaisei, which is a nonprofit organization based in San Francisco and Hong Kong. Doug is a Hong Kong resident, but originally from California. He is in town here in San Francisco for the launching of Project Kaisei's mission to the North Pacific Gyre. Doug Woodring, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit more about what the North Pacific Gyre actually is.
Sure. The North Pacific Gyre is an area of ocean currents. All of the big oceans have current flows where the currents come together and basically makes like a large whirlpool. But it is so large that it's not as doesn't create a dense area that you might think of in an island that you can go out to. But it's thousands of square miles. Last year on our expedition, we actually sampled 3,500 miles of surface water with regular sampling of nets that were just 1 meter wide at the mouth, and we got plastic in every single sample over 1 month. So what happens is these currents allow material that is floating to basically stay stuck in that zone. And if the material is slightly under the water, the wind won't impact it and it will stay in this current area for years and years. And since plastic doesn't biodegrade, organic material would degrade, but everything that we've been putting into the ocean for the last 50 years, we're finally realizing that it doesn't go away, and away is out there, and that's what we found. There are five big gyres in the world's oceans, so North, South Pacific, Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean.
And they all have accumulations
of
plastic.
And they all have plastic, but we don't know how much. In fact, we don't even know in the North Pacific how much there is.
Which gets us back to Project Kaisei.
We're trying to figure that out. We'll probably never know how much exactly is out there. A lot of this, what we found, at some point the buoyancy changes and things are sinking, so we really have no way at the moment of knowing how much is actually at the bottom. We're really dealing with the stuff that's just floating and near the surface. And we're trying to find ways to get it out of the ocean, trying to find ways to remediate it and turn it into secondary products so at least we could help subsidize some of a cleanup. But then use that new technology, which could be used on land anywhere in waste management process, to at least be a new revenue stream for garbage that today just simply does not get recycled. Roughly 90% of the world's plastic that's made does not make it to the recycling process. And we need to find ways to, and this is a big opportunity, is to find ways to turn this waste into something more valuable. If there's a economic value on it, then it won't get tossed away and thrown into a river or stream or the street or a landfill and end up in the ocean potentially.
If you listen to listen to the water. You will hear the sound. You will hear the sound.
Now back to our discussion with Doug Woodring of Project Kaisei on SeaChange Radio. And these plastics are accumulated from thousands of miles around the globe, right? And this is just a meeting point?
That is correct. So they're coming from Asia. They're coming from North America, Mexico, the island nations, wherever the wind and current sort of take them. If they haven't gone back into shore onto a beach, then they often will end up in this zone.
And this zone is actually water, right? They're not washing ashore on
That's correct. It's just floating. You know, there's nothing out there. It's 4,000 meters deep. And it's one of the most remote ecosystems on the planet, actually. It's not in the shipping channels. The sailors don't like to go there because in the summer it's a high pressure zone. There's no wind. And that's one of the reasons no one's really known about this, because no one goes there.
Is it like an iceberg in terms of the depth? It's not over the surface, so you can't actually see it by Google Maps or anything.
That's
like correct. That, correct?
So what happens with plastic in the ocean is that it does not biodegrade, but it photodegrades. So that when it's exposed to the sun day in and day out, it gets brittle, much like your lawn furniture might get brittle after it's been in the sun for many years. And that breaks up and then becomes smaller and smaller pieces, and that so far has not been visible by satellites, so we do not have any easy way to see where this is. The way that we know where the currents have gone have been from buoys with satellite transponders that have been set in the ocean. There's thousands of buoys out there now that just float with the currents, and that allows us to see where the tracking of this circulation flow would be. But the material mainly is roughly 2 to 3 meters deep. But we were the first group to actually find plastic at 200 meters down and one piece at 160 meters when we were doing some water testing with canisters that are only 10 liters in volume.
Walk us through what a possible scenario for that removal would entail.
Well, we're looking, a lot of people think that you can just go out and drag big nets around. You cannot do that. There are two types of material that are floating out there. One are the new pieces, which are your fresh peaches, pieces, if you will, that come off of land. That's your bottles and your normal waste that you would see coming out of a river or off of a boat or out of a garbage can. And that has not yet broken down. So those items, if we find areas of big accumulation, we can pull those out with normal fishing techniques and make sure that there's no marine life caught in that. In fact, the gyre at 4,000 meters deep where we were has very little nutrients in the water at that surface, and there's not a lot of marine life there. So that is not a huge issue, but we also want to try to capture some of the smaller material, and we're looking at passive netting that will not use a lot of energy. We don't want to tow around big nets with small filament just to catch little bits of plastic. We'd have more like a fence line or a boom line that can go against the wind and the current and just collect debris, and we would go along with boats and pull from that from time to time. Once we get that material, we can then potentially even remediate that at sea if the volume is enough to justify having the remediation technology on the boat. And in the perfect world, that technology is something that can reliquefy the plastic into a diesel product, and that means we could actually use that for the boats to keep the whole cleanup going. Now, I don't know if it's going to be enough to keep it 100% self-fulfilling in terms of that taking out and refueling, but at least we would be able to subsidize some of the cleanup and then get rid of it so on the spot, so we don't have to take it back into shore.
When was this Pacific Trash Vortex discovered, Doug?
People have been aware of it when they've sailed through this area maybe 20 years ago. Charles Moore from Algolita was really the one who brought this to the world's attention 10 or 11 years ago.
Doug, can you tell us a little bit about the launch that's about to occur later today?
Yes, this is our second trip into the North Pacific Gyre. The Kaisei, which is a 150-foot brigantine vessel, which we took last year in coordination with a Scripps oceanography vessel. This year we'll be going out really looking at testing new catch methods to figure out how to get some of the debris out of the water. And the Kaisei will be joined by a tug and a barge out of San Diego in about a week to actually carry larger amounts of debris so that we can bring them back to shore and test them for remediation and show that this plastic debris can be turned into secondary products, whether that is turning it into fuel, diesel fuel, or other products that can be used and have some value to them. This is a global issue. It's a perfect case of tragedy of the commons, where we don't have any jurisdiction of any government owning this issue. And that is actually a problem because we can't go to one country and say, hey, you're at fault, you need to clean it up. We are all at fault. This is a planetary problem that has sort of snuck under our radar over the last 50 years. And we didn't really know that all of this waste is something that just does not go away. And we need to really look at how we use materials, particularly for single-use products. Many of the plastic items that are made on the planet, in fact, about 50% of all plastic made is for single-use disposable products. And we use them for maybe 30 seconds to stir our coffee, to drink a drink, to eat a salad, and then that stuff lasts 500 years or more. And we really need to reinvent the way that those materials are used or reused or what they're made of that can be biodegradable. And the dream solution eventually is going to be ocean degradability, because something that's biodegradable today may not degrade well in the ocean with the cold temperatures and salt water.
Environmental and technology entrepreneur and founder of Project Kaisei, Doug Woodring, thanks so much for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, we spoke with Ethan Daniels, a photojournalist whose new book is Under Cape Cod Waters. Now let's hear from Ethan as he shares with us a first-hand glimpse of the work of currents and plastics in the Pacific Ocean. Ethan, as a marine adventurer, you often lead teams into fairly remote areas. Do you ever encounter debris? And we hear about the enormous amount of plastic spread across the Pacific. Have you witnessed this firsthand at all?
On one of my recent trips in Indonesia, we had just crossed the equator and we're heading up to some beautiful limestone islands in eastern Indonesia. And it was strange. I'd been to this area maybe a dozen times before, and we pulled into this extremely remote lagoon, very enclosed on three sides by high limestone islands, has a beautiful white sand beach leading up to it, and looked down into the water, and the entire lagoon was covered with plastic. It was really strange. And, you know, I had never seen this occur in Indonesia before, at least in this area before. And you see plastic quite a bit, but I'd never seen this aggregation of it. And one of my colleagues who lives in Indonesia has only seen this a few times and really attributes the occurrence to changes in local currents or local current gyres. And it just goes to show that a lot of this plastic is out there in deeper water, but you just never see it. And occasionally it drifts into areas that people visit, and then you realize, oh my gosh, there is an unbelievable amount of trash, even in an area with no human population, hundreds of miles from the nearest village. So, you know, what does that say about the rest of the ocean? So it's, on the other hand, you look down amongst all this garbage and there's a ton of juvenile species of fish, which aren't normally there because they're actually using this garbage as a particular habitat. And so it was quite a strange experience. And that was just fairly recently. I went back there several months later and the garbage was completely gone. And not because people picked this stuff up, just because currents literally washed this stuff away out to sea. And yet, when you see something like this, it really sticks in your mind and it's hard to get it out of your mind. And so I'm certainly well aware of what happens to my garbage, at least how much garbage I produce, I should say. And how much recyclable material that we produce.
That's photojournalist Ethan Daniels on Sea Change Radio. It's looking like the recent flooding in Pakistan may be the worst natural disaster in human history, and the lack of donations has been shameful. To learn more about what you can do, please go to seachangeradio.com for links to our favorite charities. My guest today on Sea Change is Dr. Chandrasekhar Narayan Spike, to his friends and colleagues. He is the leader of the Science and Technology Organization of IBM's Almaden Research Center. He's been with IBM for 26 years, and for the last 5 or so years, he's been heading up the Science and Technology Organization within IBM's Research Center. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Spike.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
I wanted to focus first on one of the new breakthroughs from your organization, the Green Chemistry Initiative. If you could tell us what that entails, that'd be great.
Okay, so this is a program that we've been working with, I guess, Stanford University for the last maybe 7 or 8 years. And it's in the area of catalysis, and more specifically in the area of organocatalysis, which is an area that is picking up a lot of interest outside because it is a way of designing polymer molecules without using metals. So usually if you look at the industry standard, metal-containing catalysts are the norm. And so they have many issues associated with them. And so this whole concept of organocatalysis that we are starting to develop has to do with eliminating the need to use metals to catalyze chemical reactions.
And what is the hope for this project in terms of the end result?
So from a perspective of why we think this is important is it gives us the ability to do renewable chemistry in the sense that we have ways that we're developing to create polymer molecules that are biodegradable, as an example, can be created from renewable sources as opposed to petroleum sources, and basically develop methods to react and form polymers in a much more environmentally friendly way, meaning use less energy, less temperature, less time. And so we use the organocatalysis as a means to develop chemical reactions and polymers and plastics in a much more energy friendly way and with less pollution to the environment and so on. So it's a much more greener way of doing chemistry in general. So it has many, many different aspects to it. One aspect that seems to have been very popular is the recycling of PET. This is the plastic bottles that we use to drink water from today. So this also gives us a way of chemically recycling PET so we don't have to create plastic bottles from petroleum sources like we do today. It gives us a chance of completely closing the loop, meaning bottle-to-bottle recycling, so we can greatly reduce how much fresh resin we manufacture from petroleum.
And my understanding is that the bottles would then also be eternally recyclable as well. Is that correct?
Exactly. So today when we say recycle plastic, when we throw these plastic bottles into the recycling bin outside our houses, they actually don't get recycled into plastic bottles again. They go to making carpets and other low grade applications like park benches and other kinds of products, which then eventually end up in the landfill. So whatever we recycle today actually ends up in the landfill, maybe through another potential path instead of directly in the landfill. So the real idea of the organocatalysis work is to prevent the large amounts of plastic ending up in the landfill, either directly from plastic bottles or through intermediate products like carpets and park benches. So this would be bottle-to-bottle recycling. So you can take all the plastic bottles, create the monomer, and then reform the plastic bottles again, all using organocatalysis as a means to facilitate these reactions.
Could this also facilitate a wider range of plastic materials being recycled?
It does two things. It opens up the kinds of plastics that can be recycled. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect, which may be very interesting, is taking these plastic bottles and making other high-value plastics with it. So, for example, we could think of high-performance plastics that can be used in automobile bodies, airplane parts, and so on. So making other high-value plastics from dirt-cheap PET bottles. So converting garbage into useful engineering materials is another aspect of this organocatalysis.
Is the end product going to be biodegradable as well?
So that is one of the options that this technology offers, is the ability to create polymers that can be biodegradable. So we can basically engineer these plastics with all kinds of interesting properties, and one of them would be biodegradability.
Could the polymer be split up into many different forms beyond PET bottles?
Absolutely. So PET is just one of the recycling possibilities, but PET could be converted to other high-strength materials, which, like I said, could be used for other applications.
You said I've worried you for years. I'm just a barfly mooching beers while you sweat over a hot stove slinging hay.
Work my fingers right down to the elbows.
Yes, I may be good for nothing, but I'm still your sweet hunk of trash.
Forced to admit it, baby.
Now back to our discussion with Spike Narayan from IBM's Almaden Research Center on SeaChange Radio.
What kind of creative solutions do you think might be a good path for us to follow to take? I've seen some studies that have as little as 10% of recyclable bottles are actually recycled. How do we tackle that problem?
Well, I think the problems are at many different levels. The issue may not be so much the collection of plastic bottles. I think the municipalities, at least the one in San Jose, does an excellent job of recycling or at least collecting the plastic bottles from the consumer. The fact that these plastic bottles cannot be effectively used to recycle them back to bottles is part of the problem, right? So even though we do a good job of collecting the bottles, a very small fraction of these bottles can actually be used to recycle simply because of the challenges associated with maintaining the mechanical strength of these polymers. So, for example, if you look at your water bottle, it's fairly flimsy. And if you use recycled plastic bottles in these products as we do today, then the strength of these plastic bottles degrade every time you recycle it. So we need to completely change the recycling methodology. And that's kind of one of the things that this technology offers, is a way of chemically recycling this plastic so the end product, when you make the plastic bottle again, does not suffer from this deterioration of mechanical properties. So we create pristine polymer, which is just as good as the original polymer. So which is why it offers you a way of recycling more plastic. So today, the reason why a lot of it is not recycled is because there is no good way to recycle it and maintain the mechanical properties that you would need in a plastic bottle. So that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is many kinds of plastics, like colored plastic bottles today. There is no method of recycling this without that color contaminating the new bottle that you're making. So all these green bottles that you see with carbonated beverages today, and red ones, there is no technology available to recycle them. So even though they're collected from the consumer, they're actually directly sent to the landfill because we don't have a technology to recycle them. So this organocatalysis technology not only recycles regular PET, but can also effectively recycle colored PET as well. So it offers you many more options to recycle. And so I think with those options, now we can start thinking about how best to increase the percentage of plastic that's recycled.
Getting back to technology, so a lot of people are aware of the BPH problems. If you have bottled water, you shouldn't reuse that and refill it up with regular water unless it says it's BPH free, correct? Mm-hmm. How does the organocatalysis process work in terms of bisphenol, is that correct?
Yeah, bisphenol A, I believe.
Bisphenol A. Yeah. Does it retain any of those characteristics?
Let me answer it in a more general way. The catalysis technology that is employed today to make these plastic bottles actually uses a heavy metal called antimony for the catalysis. And so this heavy metal stays in the bottle even after the bottle is made. And that's one of the problems we have with the metal-containing catalyst technologies. What this organocatalysis offers is a way of eliminating the catalyst after it has done its job of creating the plastic from which you make the bottle. So I think you have more control over what stays in the bottle and what doesn't by using organocatalysis technologies. So I think it's much more amenable to getting products with exactly the kind of composition and chemicals you want in it rather than having stuff in it simply because there's no other way to make the bottle without them. So I think it offers us the luxury of tailoring these things a little bit better.
How long do you think we're away from consumers being able to drink from these type of bottles?
I think to a large extent it depends on how quickly we form partnerships with major companies to kind of put this in practice. So we are right now at a point where we're starting to scale up from laboratory scale to some kind of a pilot scale. Going from grams to kilograms is the first challenge. So we are right now, as we speak, in the transition process of scaling up to create kilograms of these kinds of materials, at which point it becomes much easier to talk about what do you do with large bags of these things as opposed to something that's so small today that it's very difficult to call it a complete recycling process, right? So the scaling up is the first step. And I think we're going to make significant progress in 2010 in demonstrating some kind of piloting of a scaling up operation, right? And so at that point, we'll be ready to engage with the bigger players to practice this on a bigger scale. So the technology is close enough that we can start piloting it.
You're doing some great work, and we really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through some of these amazing projects that you and your team are engaged in.
Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity to chat with you today. It's been fun.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band, Traffic, Herbie Hancock, Louis Armstrong, and Billie Holiday. Special thanks to Kuva Coffee, Bounty Growing System, and 100 Watt Network for their support. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.